WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
We're talking today about the main event of SummerSlam 1997 between Bret the Hitman Hart and The Undertaker for the WWE Championship. And I remember this match as being, you know, a good match with an incredible finish. But rewatching it, it's a masterpiece. I mean, it's incredible. It's really, really well done. The whole thing is just brilliant. I would put it on the level of any of The Undertaker's best matches, to be honest.
Yeah, it's interesting because whenever there's like a DVD release of really great Undertaker matches or even really great Bret Hart matches, they've gone with the Undertaker-Bret Hart match from the show they did in England about a couple weeks later.
Yeah, One Night Only, I think it was called.
One Night Only, yeah. I want to say One Night Stand, but it certainly wasn't that at the time. and that is a great match by itself, and I think they go with that match because on its own it holds up better, whereas this match requires a ton of context.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but at the same time I will say that the quality of this match is great by itself.
Yes,
right. There's all the stuff at the beginning, there's all the stuff with Shawn Michaels, but the match here between Taker and Bret is great just by itself.
Yeah, there's a real level of intensity and a real, like, everything hits hard, everything has good impact. Like, even, like, there's a decent length bear hug on Undertaker putting it on Bret, and he holds him up the whole time. It's not like one of those lazy bear hugs where they're both standing and he's just sort of slumped over, and he, you know, kind of, like, ratchets it in pretty tightly. There's just a different level of intensity than you see in, you know, in wrestling matches that are not as good, I guess.
It's true. It's really, really hard hitting.
Yes.
It speaks very much to the idea that in 96, 97, 98, the undercard of the show was kind of lame, but the main events of every single pay-per-view were worth watching.
Yeah, kind of the opposite of what WCW was doing at the time.
Yeah, that's sort of the basic idea. And you know, you could definitely say like the main event of whatever WCW's pay-per-view at the time was. I think it was Luger and Hogan around here.
Right.
You know, again, like this blows anything WCW is doing main event-wise out of the water.
Right.
So yeah, let's get into it.
Sure. Well, I mean, basically, some of the context. Undertaker had become champion at WrestleMania, had the WrestleMania to SummerSlam reign. In fact, now that I think about it, he kind of reminds me of Benoit's 2004 reign as far as sort of, you know, he was there, he was champion, kind of rewarded for, you know, longtime service, was the focus at times, but really the summer of 97 was all about Bret Hart and the Hart Foundation, you know, mostly against Steve Austin. I mean, that was really the focus of that summer. So, you know, Undertaker had some things. I guess he had a little bit of a feud with Farouk, you know, and the big thing really was that Paul Bearer had come back and was and kept saying that Undertaker's brother was not really dead. So introducing the Kane character, but this was months before Kane actually debuted, which was at the Hell in the Cell in October, I believe. So this was still 2 months away. In fact, he even comes out during the match and Vince addresses that he claims Undertaker's brother's still alive. And even Vince speculates whether we might see Kane tonight, which of course we do not.
Wouldn't see him for 2 more months.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, that was a really incredibly well done story and, you know, slow burn for that for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And then Michaels, he had been, of course, he missed that WrestleMania after his infamous losing a smile injury. Came back briefly around May and had a deal where he was he teamed with Austin. They were tag champions briefly, and then that kind of fell apart. Then he and Brett had a real life fight, and Shawn went away for a backstage, and then Shawn went away for a couple of months, and then came back and was the special referee here. And the stipulation was that Brett, if he lost, would never wrestle in the United States again, and Shawn had to call it down the middle, or I forget exactly what the penalty would be if he didn't call it down the middle.
The stipulation, and I think that's one of the reasons this match doesn't get as archived as much, is because there's a lot going on.
Yes.
There's a lot going on plot-wise. So going in, it's in the narrative now that Brett and Shawn don't like each other.
Yeah.
Shying away from that. And like, don't like each other in capital letters.
Yes.
So the idea was that Shawn got shoehorned in as the referee here. I don't exactly remember how he became the referee. I think it's because he was... he suggested that a regular referee would not be able to, you know, be tough enough between these two forces.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Something like that. That's, you know, the regular reason that wrestlers become referees.
Yeah.
But the idea was that he would be way too partial towards the Undertaker. So whoever was like the...
Gorilla Monsoon, I think.
It was Monsoon
who
made it, you know, quote-unquote fair, in the sense that Shawn couldn't be partial towards the Undertaker or he would be fired.
Right.
And if Bret Hart lost the match, he promised to never wrestle in the U.S. again.
Right.
So the ending is essentially telegraphed going in based on those two kind of giant hammers of plot.
Sure, right? but how they were going to get there was the question, because
exactly
because the finish, which is brilliant, that's a hard one to see coming. I mean, you can do all the fantasy booking you want. I mean, I think everyone in wrestling will try to map out how the story is going to go and try to figure out where they're going to go next, and that's just part of being a fan. But figuring out how they were going to get out of this in a satisfying way was I mean, that this is a tricky one.
Yeah, certainly. So let's cool. So that's the beginning of it. The match begins. I mean, the entrances are great. Just about every other time that a wrestler has been a referee, he's the person to come out first, and they generally have like a slightly more demure, muted entrance than they usually would, but not Shawn Michaels.
No,
Shawn Michaels comes out after Bret Hart. Before the Undertaker, and has, you know, the kind of entrance that Shawn Michaels had in 97.
Yes. By the way,
fireworks, everything.
Yeah. Did you know that many people feel Shawn Michaels personifies America's youth today?
Yeah, Vince McMahon seems to think that.
Yes.
I enjoyed Jim Ross's line that now all the referees are going to demand fireworks.
Yes. You know, Ross was really good as the third man, like kind of throwing in the quips like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, obviously he's one of the greatest play-by-play guys, but he really filled that third man role pretty well too. So
absolutely.
Yes. Yeah, there were actually stipulations for all the Hart Foundation members, because there was the Gold Dust Brian Pillman thing where Pillman had to wear a dress. There was British Bulldog and Ken Shamrock where Bulldog would have had to eat a can of dog food. And then there was the infamous Austin-Owen match where if Austin didn't win the title, he would have to kiss Owen Hart's ass. So,
right.
Which led to a problem when Austin's neck was almost broken, and but he still had to win the match. But...
all of that stuff led to, I think, SummerSlam being kind of dull compared to the previous show they did, Canadian Stampede.
Okay.
Which is still heralded as one of the best shows they've ever done.
Yeah. I think this show's pretty good. But it's not as good as Calgary Stampede. That's for sure. But,
exactly. It's not as good as Calgary Stampede. I do think it's better than the show they did after with what I forget what it's called.
Pro?
With Undertaker and Shawn in the match that ended in the Big Schmoz.
Right.
But SummerSlam 97, I feel, suffers from too many predetermined guarantees.
Okay.
I don't know, just, yeah, the number of if this happens, then this will happen.
Okay. I liked it because it was different at the time. I can see how it was a little bit overdone, though. I can see that argument. I like during the entrances where after Undertaker comes in and then he does, he lifts his hands up and then there's sort of an explosion and the lights go up. I like how Bret kind of shrugs it off a little bit. Like he can tell he kind of gets the slight spook and then he's like, oh yeah, this doesn't bother me at all, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He does that little thing where I like the little shiver he does.
Yeah.
And then he grips his hands and he's like, all right, I can do this.
Yeah.
Bret would throw in those little details. I don't know if he was performing or if he was just reacting to the pomp of it all.
Right.
I will say I do prefer that version of Undertaker's entrance to the one that's sort of become canonical where he slowly raises the hands and the lights slowly go up.
Okay.
I've always preferred the explosive one.
Yeah. Well.
But that's just me.
They both have their merits. I don't sweat really too much, but yes, the explosion one was cool. No doubt. I also like how Sean really tries to be like a vigilant ref to the point of obnoxiousness, like when he's checking both their like shoes and their, you know, and for foreign objects and checking, them very thoroughly. And then of course he interjects himself very heavily into the match in several occasions, particularly getting into it with Bret. But I guess this is pretty much how Shawn Michaels would be as a referee, because Shawn Michaels can't really help himself but be obnoxious, especially during this time.
Yeah. It's a weird match for that reason, too. There's a lot of great wrestling here, and a lot of great Bret Hart Undertaker wrestling, which...
Yeah.
You know, they were known for having good matches, but not necessarily with each other. They didn't really fight as often as you'd think, being the two biggest guys in the company for a while.
Yeah. Well, they're both good guys for the most part. So.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. What do you think about Undertaker performing here as sort of an underdog good guy?
Yeah, that was weird because I was just thinking that Bret takes most of this match. I mean, he takes probably 70-75% of this match.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole lot of, Bret overpowers him at times. I mean, grabs him, runs him into the post. I mean, Bret is presented as roughly the physical equal of Undertaker through a lot of this. I mean, there's kind of the initial part where Bret tries to cheat and kind of goes after him with some I think he kind of nails him with the belt a little bit and then, kind of punches him in the corner. And then Undertaker immediately, takes advantage, pounds him, throws him around, goes after him outside, that kind of stuff. But, yeah, there's a lot of – and later on when there's when Bret has the sharpshooter locked, like Undertaker, powers out of it incredibly, kind of – which Ross sells as the first time anyone's broken the sharpshooter. So there is that stuff. But, yeah, a lot of it really is Bret, just methodically going after Undertaker's knee, going after the leg. I mean, and just really hard hitting, a lot of – headbutts and some offense you didn't really see from Bret that much. I mean, this kind of made me think of like a Vader match. I mean, not quite as stiff, but it was, as far as like the style of it, it really kind of felt like that to me.
Yeah. And it's weird too, because you wouldn't necessarily see Bret being a dominant bad guy too often.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting. You don't think of Undertaker being somebody you can overpower too easily.
No. Yeah, and I mean, with, the other monsters that he faces, then, yeah, I mean, that's more understandable. A Kane thing or even Vader. But yeah, Bret, you just think of – I mean, and he's working. I mean, he's incorporating a lot of technical skill. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously, that's his style. But it really is – you know, he really does methodically work over Undertaker, and Undertaker's doing a lot of, you know, selling the pain of what Bret is putting him through.
Yeah. There's this one moment where Bret's about to put – it's his first sharpshooter attempt, mm-hmm. and Undertaker grabs him by the throat. And when I was watching that, I was thinking, is he going to do the Gugula Plata here? Because this is what he would do in the 2000s if somebody ever tried to wrap him up with his legs. But here he just stands up and tries to choke slam him, which I think shows that Undertaker wasn't as focused on being a quote-unquote chain wrestler at the time. He was still just pure power WWF moves.
Yeah.
That's not like... I don't know when he started doing the submission stuff. I think it was around 2002 or so.
Yeah, it was. I'm pretty sure it was 2002.
During that bad guy phase he was in?
Yeah.
But man, like, did that happen to you too, where you sort of saw beats where a more modern Undertaker would do something, but the 90s Undertaker simply didn't?
Yeah.
In this match?
Yeah, I know. I thought the same thing during that spot, and I agree. He was, you know, obviously he's evolved a lot since then. I mean, he had, although by 97, he clearly had advanced a lot from the 92, 93 days where he was just really doing the character and doing the basic moves and not really, he had already broadened himself quite a bit at this point.
Yeah, it's, In no way is he sort of the bad wrestler that he was in 94, 95 here.
Right.
He's obviously improved, but he's not quite to the point where you revere an Undertaker match yet. You still think of it as more sports entertainment-y.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
But this is definitely shades of what the Undertaker would become later in terms of marquee matches.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, this was one of his first... You know, he had the ones with Mankind, but those really those were kind of more hardcore style brawls. I mean, they a little bit less violent than they would later get. But this is like very much a, you know, WWE heavyweight style main event style match. Like, this is maybe his first great one. You know, I mean, you know, he had some, you know, pretty good brawls, but this really, you know, was. This really does foreshadow the kind of the run he would have, you know, later in the 2000s, kind of starting in, you know, 05, 06 ish, you know, where he was able to have great matches in that style without relying, you know, on the brawling and the blood and, you know, and stipulation stuff.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, really good stuff by Bret here. A lot of stuff that you'd see, like shades of, like, him being inspired by Ric Flair's style of breaking down a knee in this match. I know Hart will never admit to being influenced by Ric Flair ever, but it's pretty obvious here. A lot of stuff where he's not... Like, he starts the match by taking the belt and whacking Undertaker with it, but during the match, he stays pretty close to the rules.
Yeah. Well, he does. I mean, he definitely, like, when he does the ring post figure four, he's very much like he does the four and then he stops and he spends a lot of time going after Undertaker outside. And that's kind of where he and Shawn get into it, because Shawn keeps insisting he goes inside and keeps sort of berating him a bit and so forth, which, you know, kind of leads to Bret losing his temper at the end. But yeah, you know, up until the finish, you're right. He really does. I mean, he doesn't do any low blows. He doesn't do any, you know, doesn't really use the ropes to his advantage or anything. But he's still able to kind of pull off, like, he's villainous, but he's also like he's like pious or virtuous. You know, that really fits that character, because like the Bret Hart who straights up, you know, is a just typical bad guy, doesn't fit with the character.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to talk about that, we can go into the difference between being morally right and being ethically right.
Sure.
That's, at the time, there's a lot of stuff with Bret where he's acting morally virtuous but ethically terrible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's sort of his whole Canada-US thing at the time, and you know, being screwed. Like, there's people think that being screwed thing started with Survivor Series 97. He started telling people that he was getting screwed by the WWF in February.
Probably,
you know, like,
yeah.
It was kind of the whole crux of his character at the point was that he felt like he was getting this short shrift from WWF and therefore the WWF fans. And so he goes on this moral crusade, right?
Mm-hmm.
But by becoming more and more of an ethically questionable character.
Yes.
Right? And you see that all over this match where, yeah, he starts the match by hitting Undertaker with the belt, right? He finishes the match by insisting that Shawn count even after a blatant use of the chair. The kind of things that, like, a virtuous villain would never do.
Yeah.
You know? But he's just willing to break every rule to make sure that he's that his morals are victorious.
Okay. That's a good distinction. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, as far as, you know, kind of some of the match highlights, we have, you know, we talked about the beginning. Eventually, Brett's able to kind of get the advantage when Undertaker goes outside and ends up clotheslining the post. Although actually Taker is able to, not soon afterward, Brett jumps off the apron and Taker catches him and then rams mm-hmm. him into the post repeatedly.
Oh yeah, it was hard.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah. And Shawn, this is kind of where Shawn and Undertaker get into it a little bit. And basically any time that Undertaker turns around and gets in his face, Shawn backs off very, very, showing his fear of the Undertaker, which of course would build into their feud that they would have right after this. So,
mm-hmm.
Good foreshadowing there. Eventually, yeah. So Undertaker really does work the back with Brett for quite a while, and then eventually Brett sort of is able to target Undertaker's knee after Undertaker misses a boot and sort of kicks it repeatedly there. Holds it across the ropes, and then Shawn, you know, keeps repeatedly counting to four, and Brett keeps breaking it. So Brett's definitely pushing the line, but he never, you know, crosses it, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
He locks in a figure four, which prompts Paul Bearer to walk out to ringside, and we get the deal with where speculation about Kane. And then eventually Undertaker rolls it over, and then after he rolls it over and then it's broken up, he does a kind of a cool thing, or he goes out after Paul Bearer and punches him. But Brett, like, chop blocks him from behind, and then we get the ring post figure four, which prompts Brett and Shawn to go face-to-face after Shawn is a little bit assertive in that five count. And then we have Pillman and Owen coming out to ringside, and then this is the kind of the cool thing where Taker slips, like, he's gonna go back against the rope, but instead he dumps himself over and then catches Brett and catches Owen and Pillman sleeping and then punches them both out, and Shawn Shawn forces them to leave and then misses Taker choke slamming Brett, and then when he's back in, it's Owen then gets a two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty ineffective interference there.
Yes. Well, it was effective in the sense that their distraction kept Undertaker from getting the win, but their distraction probably prompted the chokeslam to begin with. So yeah, it's kind of a wash. So
yeah, exactly.
But then when Taker gets mad at Shawn and grabs him, then Brett gets a quick roll up for two, and then that prompts Taker to threaten Shawn in the corner again, who is again very much not very intimidated by the Undertaker in this. Shawn does really, like, he's good in the counts. Like, he is showing, like, pretty good balance here. I mean, he's definitely, like, showing his disdain for Brett, but he's showing his he's actually seems pretty effective as a referee, which Ross and Vince keep pointing out to the point of almost ad nauseum.
Yeah. One of the things that's actually I find difficult to watch going back and looking at things from 97 is how favorable the commentary is towards anything Shawn Michaels does ever.
Yeah.
Right? Regardless of whether what he's doing is right, wrong, cheap quality, good, bad. Everything that Shawn Michaels ever does is brilliant.
Yeah, I found that to be true. And I find that's true with Diesel, too, in the, you know, obviously he wasn't around at this point, but in the, you know, 94, 95, 96 era, like Vince definitely had his favorites.
Yeah, of course. I mean, what that says is they perceived Shawn Michaels to be the WWF franchise guy. Whenever they have a guy like that, there's a different tone in commentary.
Uh-huh.
You know, you see it whenever they consider John Cena to be the main guy.
Right.
You definitely see it whenever they consider, like, Randy Orton to be the main guy. Mm-hmm. And that has shifted back and forth over the last few years, I feel. I think that they consider Orton at the moment to be sort of the main guy in the same sense as they considered Michaels at this point, in that regardless of his actions, he is cheered by commentary.
Right. Do you think Brett ever got that kind of same?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. 93, 94.
Okay.
Absolutely. Anything Brett did was cheered by commentary.
Okay. Do you think it was with the same vigor and the same enthusiasm? I mean, I'd have to go back and sort of study it, but
it's tough to say because that rule in WWE to, you know, evangelize your main guy regardless of action wasn't always in place. Right. It certainly wasn't in place like in the Hogan Savage era.
Oh, you don't think right? so?
I don't think so. I mean, obviously you've got, you know, the good guy commentator cheering the good guy. But in this regard, you've got Vince McMahon, Jerry Lawler and JR all saying great things about Shawn.
That's true. Yeah, that's a good point. You would have Ventura as the counterweight or Heenan as Gorilla's counterweight. And they're. You know, even though they were, you know, the bad guys, they would be allowed to make good, smart points and be able to sort of, you know,
Every now and then you would hear Gorilla agree with Heenan on something about something Hogan did.
That's true. It didn't happen too often,
I think that rule started becoming a thing with Michaels. So okay. I think that's why you didn't see as much evangelizing about Brett, because they instilled this rule with Michaels that like. And maybe Diesel, too, because they had Diesel slightly before Michaels. Maybe Diesel was the first one they really went gung-ho with this thing on.
Yeah.
But they've done that ever since.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's a fair point. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think maybe not as much Austin because of the story of him being against the WWE, but even at times, you know,
yeah,
that might have been there. So that's an interesting thought. I hadn't really, it, you know... had that a complete theory in my mind, but that's some good thinking.
That's what you bring me on the show for, Jason.
That is what I do. I do. You fill my gaps so well. So.
Oh God.
All right. Anyway.
It's a family show.
So.
PG.
Yes. Mm.
Right in the kisser.
Yes. Exactly. So
back to the match, Jason.
Right, back to the match. So Brett again, more with the has the repeated headbutts to the back, works the backbreaker, and we've kind of have Undertaker trying to rock the zombie sit up here, kind of showing that he's, subtly showing that supernatural side, although you know he feels very human through most of this. Brett kind of works his usual, he gets a snap suplex, gets a second rope elbow, which is complete with middle fingers to the crowd. And in fact, we get another kick out with a zombie sit up, and Ross says that Brett might have won if he hadn't have done the middle fingers, which I sort of doubt. But he follows with a DDT and then Taker's a little bit slower to get up on that one.
Mm-hmm.
And we have – then Taker makes a bit of a comeback, gets a waist lock and drops Brett's face under the turnbuckle, nails a bunch of headbutts, and then Brett follows with headbutts to Undertaker's back in the Russian leg sweep. And then Brett taunts the crowd, which just gets amazing, amazing heat. Like he really was – he was just – really gung-ho here, and it's weird in retrospect that given the amount of heat and giving the amount of focus that he was getting, that would completely dwindle after this match. And leading up into the Survivor Series, which we can get into a little bit after the finish.
You remember Wrestling with Shadows, right? They focused on this match.
Right.
There's a good, like, 10-15 minute point in Wrestling with Shadows where they talk about what happens because of this match.
Yes, absolutely.
And Brett talks about this, about Sean's, he uses the word scooping. Scooping
right.
is heat.
Exactly.
Because, you know, yeah, he was the bad guy in WWF going into this match and during this match. You could hear it from the crowd. But the second he wins the title, the second Shawn Michaels counts the, like, hits Undertaker with a chair, counts the three, and walks out,
mm-hmm.
Bret Hart's heat is gone.
Yes.
And it happens instantly. You can hear the crowd just nothing.
Yeah.
They're not booing Bret. They're booing Michaels.
Yeah.
They're not booing Bret. Mm-hmm. But they boo Bret throughout the match. But the second he wins the belt, nothing. No reaction.
Yeah.
It's one of those times where you think, yeah, Bret's always been a little paranoid about, like, his spot in the company and how the audience perceives him and his character. But he is spot on about what happened here.
Yeah.
Like, he's just gone. Like, he's just – and you can definitely say, like, his last 3 months in the company, save Survivor Series, is noteless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? It's very much – I mean, they bring in, like, the Patriot. And it's very,
yeah,
like the standard, yeah, Canada, U.S. It just becomes, like – you know, even though he's champion, yeah, it just becomes – and it's definitely the secondary thing on the show. I mean, you know, the really Austin and, you know, Undertaker and Michaels is the focus up until – you know, then they kind of – they build it back up a little bit before Survivor Series, obviously. But,
mm-hmm.
But yeah. So – he tries the sharpshooter, and then Undertaker gets the throat and a knee lift. Then they battle for a bit. He tries a choke slam, but Brett gets him with a kick in the knee, but Taker follows with a huge series of punches, gets the flying clothesline. He throws Brett chest first into the turnbuckle, gets a boot and a leg drop for two, and then Brett ends up sort of slipping out on the apron, and then Taker grabs him and picks him up and lifts him with, like, a really big choke slam, like, halfway across the ring. But that only gets two. So then the announcers are impressed that he was able to kick out of that big choke slam. Then Taker tries to go for the rope walk, but Brett crotches him on top of the turnbuckle. He gets the superplex. The first one gets a little bit, they collapse a bit, but then they're able to get it. And then he hits a big superplex and then follows with the sharpshooter, which, as we mentioned before, Undertaker ends up really kicking Brett halfway across the ring, and Brett even ends up falling out of the ring, kind of a little bit of an exaggerated sell, but still kind of cool. I like how Ross really sold that as an epic moment.
He sells it as an epic moment. He references WrestleMania 13, where Austin is incapable of breaking the sharpshooter.
Right.
And Undertaker just sort of, like... I mean, he's there for a minute, but you don't really see his face. You don't see any of the pain. His head's down. And then he just, like, overpowers him.
Yeah.
It's kind of cartoony how it happens, but a lot of stuff with The Undertaker's, you know, supposed mystical strength was pretty cartoony. And that's just, unfortunately, a consequence of the time and his character.
Sure.
But, yeah, this was the moment where I think Bret Hart's sharpshooter stops being an effective weapon.
As effective, I guess.
Yeah, you know, because, like, WrestleMania 13, I think, made the move impenetrable, mm-hmm. right? And then SummerSlam is just like, Undertaker just kicked out of it, and you can just kick out of the sharpshooter?
Yeah.
Huh? Is that a thing you can do?
It is a thing that can happen, yeah. So.
Yeah.
And then we have, and then he tries to do a sharpshooter on the ring post. Oh, actually, Brett slips out of a tombstone first, and then he drags him and then tries to set up the ring post sharpshooter. Can't really lock it real good, and then Taker ends up kicking Brett into Sean, and then Sean hurts his knee, and they're both on the outside. Brett uses Sean being incapacitated to grab a chair and then nail Taker in the head. Yeah, tosses it away, but it really doesn't go quite out of the ring, which is an important
thing. Mm-hmm.
Sean, he slips in with the hurt knee, but then that only gets two. And then Brett pounds after him some more, and that's when Shawn notices the chair in the corner. He grabs it, he confronts Brett, and then Brett, you know, yells back at him, then finally spits in his face. Shawn just has a moment of, you can tell there's a moment of conflict there, or a moment of, you know, like, okay, what am I going to do? And then he immediately takes the swing at Brett. Brett ducks, and he nails Taker right across the head. Taker slumps down. Brett goes on top of Undertaker, and he points at Shawn, demands that he counts, and then Shawn reluctantly goes down, puts the hand down once, twice, then a bit of a pause, and then the third one, and then storms out of the ring, frustrated probably at himself, and you know, knows what's going to happen, and it's kind of weird that was his heel turn. Like, I mean, I know it was, and I understand why it was, but it's like, you know, of all the things that, you know, that he did wrong, this was more on the mistake level. I mean, it's like, you could argue that he was justified at swinging that chair, just obviously hit the wrong guy.
I mean, that was his action to become a bad guy. His explanation the night after, the 8-9 minute long monologue he gives,
sure,
is the crux of it. That's when people start to realize that Sean's a bad guy.
Right. But him here. I mean, it's clear that he's being painted that way. But yeah, obviously the next night cements it for sure. No. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting, and you're right. The reaction when Brett's celebrating with the belt is really fight, even though this finish is brilliant. And I think they, you know, like, I don't think Brett was like, you know, he could have been involved in they could have done a big thing with him the next night and had him back to where he was. I mean, I think the next couple months of how he was used was, you know, kind of, you know, the follow-up from this, you know, was also a hindrance to him, you know.
Well, you know what's interesting, yeah. I find? So a couple things here. I've actually got 3 points.
Sure.
And I'll go last point first. Okay. Before SummerSlam, The Undertaker's WWF title reign was very much second fiddle to the main narrative of WWF, mm-hmm. right? Even the tag belts during the spring were considered more interesting than the WWF title.
Sure.
Because of Shawn and Austin, right?
Right.
The Intercontinental title, because of Austin, was more interesting than the WWF title, right? Okay. Like, people remember Austin winning the Intercontinental title at SummerSlam more than they remember Brett winning the WWF title at SummerSlam.
Yeah.
And again, it's because of Austin's broken neck, it is all that. But in 97, in the WWF, for some reason, the WWF title, even though it was, you know, in the main event of WrestleMania, the main event of SummerSlam, the main event of Survivor Series, all their big shows of the year centered around the WWF title. Mm-hmm. Outside of those shows, the belt was not particularly focused on. And you can see that with Undertaker from spring to summer. And you see that from SummerSlam to Survivor Series, right? Like, the fact that he's the WWF champion is really, really, like, third.
It's almost incidental.
It's almost incidental. And I have no idea why. I don't know why. It's not just Brett, because Undertaker was just as put down the card because of the... I mean, didn't Undertaker, like, open the show, Canadian Stampede?
No, it was
low down.
Yeah, well, there were only, like, 4 matches, but it was, like, second or third, so...
Yeah. So, but, I mean, and even before WrestleMania, like, Sid's reign as champion, the kerfuffle at the beginning of the year... where it was sort of a hot potato for a minute.
Yeah.
It was a weird year for the belt. And so what happened here was that Brett was taking a belt that Undertaker had sort of been saddled with, in a sense, mm-hmm. and now he was saddled with it. Mm-hmm. Instead of being this lofty thing that meant that you were the head of the company, the WWF title in 1997 meant that, yeah, you were the WWF champion, but that doesn't necessarily mean the story here is about you.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And yeah, immediately the story becomes Shawn and Taker, which doesn't involve the belt until the Rumble.
Right.
You know? Like, for they feud for 5 months there, and the belt is only involved at the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
in maybe their least good match.
Sure. Yeah.
In 98, the belt would become a lot more important, obviously, with Austin.
Yeah.
But, I mean, yeah, you've got Austin in 97, who is incredibly important to the whole story. And you could say, in a sense, that Austin took Hart's spot as the conflicted hero, like the anti-hero type. Mm-hmm. And they essentially didn't need Brett anymore. And I think they felt that. You could tell that Brett was on his way out.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a weird... I mean, it's just weird that he was so the focus of 1997, and then they're like, okay, well, let's move, or the early part of 97, they were like, okay, well, let's move away from him now. It's weird how quick that shift happened, I guess. And knowing kind of the backstage stuff, it makes sense because, you know, Vince wanted to get out of that contract, and there were, you know, I mean, anyone who has seen Wrestling with Shadows and who's read about Montreal, which is probably most people listening to this, would know the basic details of this. If you don't, you should. You should see those things.
But, certainly.
But yeah, it's just weird how, and you know, honestly, like, you know, Bret Hart is one of my favorite wrestlers and is one of the greatest wrestlers of all time, I think. But you know, honestly, they didn't need Bret Hart. I mean, they really did, and they didn't need Shawn Michaels either. That's the thing, because mm-hmm. Shawn Michaels went away at WrestleMania 14, and they didn't miss a beat without him. You know.
Nope.
And they, yeah. I mean, and they were pretty, I mean, you know, I mean, I think that they, you know, they got rid of Bret Hart because they thought Shawn Michaels was so important to them. And that's certainly part of the reason. I mean, they picked Shawn over Bret, you know, which is kind of wild given, you know, Shawn's behavior over the last couple of years. But, you know, they felt he was the greater talent, and I can understand why they felt that way. He was certainly younger and, you know, more marketable in a certain sense. So, especially once he kind of caught fire with the DX stuff.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't know. It's hard to say what you shouldn't have done. This is one of the most talked about periods in wrestling.
Yeah,
ever, right?
For a good reason, because there's so much compelling stuff going on. Yeah.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah.
Certainly.
I mean, this, by the way, this show is the night that hooked me again permanently as a wrestling fan. Basically this, and then the next night with both the Raw and the Nitro. The Nitro was, we've talked about before, the Lex Luger Hulk Hogan title change, and then this, you know. So I'd been sort of already getting into it pretty seriously, but this was like, okay, now I'm going to watch every week kind of thing. So
yeah, exactly. It's interesting because I'll talk about this in a second. I want to go back to my first 2 points. These are details at the end of the match.
Sure, you do that.
The chair, how, if you were to say throw a chair, how far do you think you could throw it?
I don't know.
Do you think you could throw it 4 to 6 feet?
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
And not 7 feet?
Oh, no, probably not.
That's what I mean. Can you throw a chair 6 feet, but not 7 feet? Because that's what Bret Hart did here. He threw a chair exactly a certain distance, but not so much that the chair exited the ring. And that's one of those little details of what makes a great wrestler is how he handles the props. Mm-hmm. And when he throws a prop away, the exact position of where it lands is very important, mm-hmm. right? You notice the chair gets almost to the edge of the ring, mm-hmm. but not over.
Yeah.
Right? It's so important. If it went over, Shawn would never see it.
Yeah.
Right? But if it's too close, then it's too obvious.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
Those kind of things, like when people talk about Bret Hart being an absolutely great wrestler, we're not just talking about how crisp his suplexes were. I'm also talking about how he acted as a character. Mm-hmm. And the little physical details of his ability, his hero work, all of that. Just the fact that he can do that without anybody really noticing. Like, that's a detail that I don't think I've ever heard anybody talk about, is how you handle an illegal object when you're trying to keep it away from a I think more people have talked about, like, how, like, Guerrero would do it, because he would do it in a really cool way. Mm-hmm. But Hart never gets talked about in the way that he would be a bad guy.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing is brilliant. And then, of course, the spitting in the face, which we can remark on now that just happened to Randy Orton at the last pay-per-view at Money in the Bank with Christian. Mm-hmm. Is there an official wrestling rule here where if somebody spits in your face, you become an enraged psychopath immediately?
I guess so.
and all rules go out the window, right? If somebody spits in your face, you, as a wrestler, are never allowed to take that in stride. You have to go crazy.
Yeah. It is a pretty it is a pretty egregious insult. You know, in real life, people usually would get very mad about being spit in their face. So, I understand it. I think that's a perfectly that is a wrestling-ism that I can accept.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah,
me too. I think that's fair to say.
Good.
Yeah.
So
yeah, let's. What was I saying? The point I was going to get back to after I mentioned those details.
I don't immediately remember.
We gotta get better at this.
Yeah. Well, nobody's perfect.
Okay. Yeah. Your point about how this night and the night after
Hooked
you as a wrestling fan.
Yes.
For me, this was the Raw after this, especially the Raw after this, is what turned me off of WWF for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I essentially missed Fall 97 in WWF, which I've gone back to and filled in the gaps. But at the time, I moved over to Nitro, and I stayed in the WCW camp until, you know, probably Fall 98 is when I sort of moved back over to watching WWF regularly. Like,
wow.
I would tune in every now and then. But for about a year, I was a WCW guy.
Interesting. I was always kind of both, and I probably favored Nitro during this time. It was probably more spring of 98 where I would say I felt WWE was consistently better. But it wasn't until late in WCW's run that I pretty much stopped watching it altogether. And I always liked to watch. I always watched both. You know, I was pretty adamant about that. Yeah, watch one and tape the other and then watch the other one later or watch the Nitro replay. I forget exactly how I did it now, but and I would repeat. I would like watch them a couple of times during a week. I mean, because, you know, we didn't have – there wasn't SmackDown. There wasn't quite Thunder yet. There was only Raw Nitro. So, I mean, you know, that was certainly enough, but I was pretty obsessed with wrestling for enough where I would watch it a few times a week and just enjoy the shows. I mean, you know, not that they were quite that good usually, but they were good enough that I was that into it. So
I think what it was for me is that, you know, Fall 97 into 98, Austin was the reason to watch WWF.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't like Austin, then there wasn't a whole lot else. There was DX, but again, like I was just, I guess, not particularly into Austin and DX. You know,
it didn't
emotionally impact me in the slightest. I can go back and appreciate it now, but it's not the thing that when I was, you know, 13 or 14 or however old I was then, it's got to gutturally hit you.
Right.
I think, and it didn't. Yeah.
DX was a I connected a lot with Austin, particularly right after this. I didn't as much with DX, although they thought they were pretty compelling at certain points. But there was a certain amount of, because they were obviously throwing away the framework of what made a good guy and what made a bad guy. And there were times where I did wonder, like, okay, who here am I – who here can I root for? Because everyone here is kind of a dick sometimes. So, you know, there was a little bit of that. Like, I get why they went away from the good guy, bad guy paradigm, and most of that is good. But, like, there was a time in WWE, and it was kind of around this time where, like, all you people are kind of unlikable. Who am I supposed to like, you know? Who am I supposed to cheer for? I think that was – with all the brilliant stuff that was happening in 97 and even into 98 a little bit, that could be a problem for me as a fan.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's something I, you know, haven't thought about in a while, but that at the time I remember that being like a little bit of an issue with me with WWE, where with WCW, the good and bad guys were much more clear most of the time anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, I could see, ooh, Sting's the good guy. Yay, go Sting, you know, kind of thing. Or Rey Mysterio, or, you know, a lot of the good guys were more evident there. And both approaches had their merits. I mean, obviously, you know, both Nitro and Raw were going great guns at this point, so mm-hmm. it was all good. So, anything else to discuss regarding the match or the era or anything?
No, I think we pretty much covered it.
Cool.
You know.
All right. Well, of course, you should check out Kay Sawyer Paul's The Footnotes of Wrestling, which is the only wrestling source that you will ever need.
That's it.
And also the Aggressive Art Podcast, which is a great listening. And, of course, come to WrestleSpective.com and FairToFlare.com. If the Footnotes of Wrestling isn't enough for you, then those other sites may help you with some.
Well, they're not in competition with one another.
But that's true.
The Footnotes of Wrestling is the only news source you need.
Yes, very good.
Fair to Flair is the best wrestling journalism on the web.
Yes, thank you for clarifying that for me. And
it's very important.
Yes, and we will of course be counting down with SummerSlam main events up until the day of the show. So keep on listening, and goodbye.
Let's be honest. Most wrestling websites suck. BS rumors, schoolyard gossip, plagiarism. It's no wonder why no one believes anything they read on the internet. Well, if you can't get something done right, you might as well do it yourself. Presenting the Fair to Flare Quarterly from the writers of FairToFlare.com and over a dozen other wrestling websites. We're not copy and pasting what we read in some newsletter. This is 100% original content from the best wrestling bloggers on the internet. In-depth analysis of the art of pro wrestling, debate, artwork, and humor. The Fair to Flare Quarterly will raise the bar of what wrestling journalism can and should be. Professionally edited and produced, and every contributor will be paid for their work. Order your copy of the Fair to Flare Quarterly today at FairToFlare.com. The better wrestling media has arrived.